Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. With me, as always, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, everybody. Hope you're doing well today. I am doing okay.
Just okay?
Just okay. It's very rainy. I'm very sore.
Well, you have the blessings of the Blood God and all of the RPGs to keep you happy.
That's true. I did finish Secret of Mana, so...
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
How was the ending?
Depressing, but I think we're going to get into that a little bit today.
I'm surprised that you went all the way through that remake.
I enjoyed it more than I thought I would at the beginning. It's just, I like to play Secret of Mana in all its forms. Like, that's one thing. But I don't know. I started to appreciate it a little bit more as I went on. I would say if you want to play Secret of Mana for the first time, yes, you should still get an SNES Classic. But it's very much like Final Fantasy IV on the DS, where if you like the original game, if you like the original experience, give it a try, just for that extra spice of variety.
We've been chastised by the Disciples of the Blood God, by the way, Nadia.
Oh, have we?
Yeah, they want us to talk about Radiant Historia, the remake.
Right, I haven't gotten around to that.
Yeah, it's out now. You should put in your 3DS and start playing it.
Yeah, I think I should, now that I'm done with Mana. And
yeah,
we're kind of getting down to the end with Cosmic Star Heroine.
We've also had people asking about the Final Fantasy 15 mobile game.
Yeah, I saw a couple of questions about that. There's also another mobile game in Final Fantasy, some sort of Dissidia game that I downloaded and I've been meaning to play. It was supposed to be like kind of funny and cute.
Hmm. Oh, so we should talk about that next week.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Obviously, in the short term, the biggest news in the RPG space is Kingdom Come Deliverance still, which has sold... Well, north of a million copies,
yeah,
at this point.
Now. Within less than 2 weeks, I believe.
I was wondering, what do you make of Kingdom Come's success?
I guess given that it's a very niche RPG in a very kind of reserved space. Like, I think you were saying on Slack the other day that there just aren't that many medieval sort of RPGs, even outside of Skyrim, even the more fantasy, like really high fantasy stuff. So they found a niche and they filled it.
A million copies is a lot, though.
That is a lot of, I have to say, I was not expecting a million copies. Like, when they hit 500,000, I'm like, oh, that's pretty good. That's probably where they're plateau, but nope, they just kept on going.
I think it's for a few reasons. First, I think the relative notoriety conferred by its creator,
yeah,
basically feuding with a number of journalists and ex-journalists. I saw him get into it with Arthur Geese about the history of the Czech Republic and the Bohemia and all that stuff, about like the role of women and all that. I think that has conferred upon the game a certain degree of notoriety that has kept it in the public space. Plus, I think that this kind of success can be exponential as more people play it and talk it up. More people are going to buy it.
Yeah, of course. That's pretty typical for indie games.
It's also received kind of a front and center promotion on Steam.
Oh, that'll do it too, yeah.
Yeah, definitely front and center promotion on Steam. There aren't a ton of games right now to play, so it's been able to... Because Monster Hunter has definitely faded away at this point.
Yeah.
So it's been a lot... It's been in the news a lot because it's generating traffic. And finally, like, it... If you don't know anything about it, it just looks cool, because it's a very easy sell to say, like, oh yeah, medieval Skyrim, that's a lot more realistic. And to somebody who's just, you know, maybe played Skyrim and really enjoyed it, that's immediately, like, that's an immediate hook of being able to say, oh, realism? Yeah. Skyrim is really fake. I want to experience history and be a knight or something.
Right, which I guess the game lets you do that. But my whole thing with... See, I'm not a tremendous fan of high fantasy, like very high fantasy, unless you actually give me those dragons and those elves and stuff like that. So otherwise, it's like, oh, it was a time period when people like crafting holes and everything was great, super. That's all I really know about medieval history.
Well, it's a good opportunity to learn about medieval history from a certain perspective, a certain angle. But I think that having played it, spent some time with it, it's definitely written from a history nerd's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think I mentioned last week that I read like several volumes of Winston Churchill's frickin' World War II history.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm kind of a nerd for history. And I think it can get really easy to get caught up in the big events and the big, all the trivia and all of the details, right? And,
right.
And you can definitely see, that aspect in this game. They are very concerned about all of the little details about what was happening in the political field at this time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so I don't know, like, do you think that this will trigger a new wave of medieval type RPGs that are set in actual history?
I can't see a situation where it doesn't happen because, well, generally, I would say, like, people always want to try to emulate that success, but then you have, like, I don't know, has anyone really tried to emulate Stardew Valley since it came out? Like, that was a huge deal. It still is a very big deal, but I haven't really seen too many, like, indie games in that same mold, barring, of course, Chucklefish's own endeavors, which are coming out soon.
I think that a big publisher could potentially have a lot of success coming out and saying, we're making a medieval RPG. It's going to be taking place during the War of the Roses, which was kind of a real life Game of Thrones situation.
Mm-hmm.
You will be a knight or something.
Of course.
You can play as a knight or you can play like a bunch of different roles. And by the way, like, we have done a bunch of research and you will also be able to play as women in this somehow.
We have done a bunch of research.
Like, women will play a role in this.
Yeah.
Because we've been doing all this research into this element of it.
Right.
And as you know, women play a large role in Game of Thrones, like backstabbing and everything. And that is something that we want to incorporate into what you could consider the real life Game of Thrones, the intrigue of the court.
Well, it's interesting because we were talking on the Flagship podcast about how Assassin's Creed Origins has the history tour, which is actually apparently really well researched and really interesting. So it's not as if games are adverse to giving us a history lesson. So yeah, I think you may be onto something when you say if it comes from anyone, it might be a AAA publisher.
Yeah, I think that when it comes to Stardew Valley, the reason that we haven't seen anybody kind of emulate it is because anybody who makes a farming simulator like Stardew Valley is just going to be like, oh, so it's another Stardew Valley.
Yeah.
Or, well, there's no way it can be as good as Stardew Valley. I've already got Stardew Valley.
That's true.
Whereas Kingdom Come is the definition of a game that I think that can be taken from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not you agree with the creator, there is a substantial number of people who simply will not play Kingdom Come because they think it's racist or sexist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly an audience that can be addressed.
Right.
And also, it's made by an indie developer with, like, I think they have like 100 people on their staff. And the game, you know, it looks like an indie game. Like, people are like, oh, this game's so gorgeous. I mean,
yeah.
On console though, I mean, it's definitely a step down from your typical open world RPGs. Like, the characters are kind of Muppet like in the way that they move. Like, they nod a little too fast.
Their mouths move a little bit funny. Like, their body motions are a little bit weird, but that's to be expected, I guess.
When you kill somebody, they ragdoll down, like, in a way that's even kind of more unnatural than, say, Skyrim. I would go as far as to say Skyrim looks better than Kingdom Come. And Skyrim is, even though Skyrim was remastered, it's also like a 7-year-old game at this point. So I think that somebody can definitely step into the breach and go, oh yeah, like this is like Kingdom Come, and it's very historically accurate, and it's set during the War of the Roses or something, or something else, and we are kind of going all out with this game, and we've learned a lot of lessons. We've learned a lot of lessons from what Kingdom Come had to offer. It's bigger and more polished, and it has a like greater number of perspectives, and we've incorporated things like court intrigue and come by your game. I would play that game.
I'm not as much of a history buff as you, but it really depends. Like, I would, if I had the time, I would absolutely get into, like I was saying, the Assassin's Creed Egyptian thing, even though I didn't think I was interested at first, but Katie made it sound really interesting. So, yeah, if someone comes by with a game that is historically accurate and it looks like it could be an interesting teacher, then sure, by all means, I'll bite.
Yeah, I think Kingdom Come shows what an untapped market history is, weirdly.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, we've had history shooters. Like, we've had your World War II shooters and World War I shooters over the years. We've had lots of strategy games hitting all different portions of history, but they've always been kind of like almost their own genre. The historical strategy game is a genre.
Yeah, like
the historical shooters always hit the same angles. So to have another genre like the RPG genre suddenly tackling history, and not only just history, but different parts of history that we haven't seen in the past,
right,
is pretty neat. I think it'd be cool if there were an RPG that was set like during the Napoleonic era, to be perfectly honest, or an RPG that was set in the period of the original Assassin's Creed.
Yeah.
I would be interested to see if you could make an RPG set during the Crusades. That I think one of the issues that I have with Kingdom Come is that it's very Eurocentric and it's very from like one perspective.
Right.
It would be interesting to see if you could accomplish an RPG that managed to tell the story of the Crusades from both a European perspective, but also from the perspective of like the Caliphate and like the Muslims and everything, because I mean, there's so much interesting stuff to mine there, right?
There really is. Yeah.
Tons of interesting material. I think a lot of developers would be nervous to go near that because there's always potential to be decried for being racist or insensitive in your approach and everything. But no, I really think that it's an interesting opportunity, especially in the current political environment where people are going on about clash of civilizations,
right,
and that kind of thing. There's a GDC session that I want to attend that's like, how can we get more Muslim representation, or not how can we get more, but like Muslim representation in video games.
Right,
like, what does that mean? What does that look like? And I don't know how exactly you could tell a story from both perspectives, or not even take it from both perspectives, but have a lens that's wide enough.
Right, yeah.
That really, it can incorporate many different angles.
You would really need a lot. You would need a pretty diverse development team. Not just development, but also a lot of consultators, a lot of people who could be there to, historians who can tell you, okay, here's what happened. Okay, no, here's an opposing opinion. Here's what actually happened. You know, come somewhere in the middle, whatever it takes. But games are generally... Yeah, until now, they've been kind of bad about tackling social issues, like with metaphors like elves and whatnot. Mm. So they are, I think developers are a little bit scared to tackle things head on.
Yeah, because, I mean, but it'll get you in the news, and that's what happened with Kingdom Come,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely, Where
that game was controversial from the off, and plenty of people swore it off, but plenty of other people were like, hell yeah, I'm going to play this game.
Yeah. And a million copies later, I mean, that's not exactly chump change.
I mean, when you got Waypoint saying, we're not going to cover this game, that's notoriety right there. People are going to want to find out why.
That's the Streisand effect right there in action.
Yeah, but yeah, I want an RPG set during the War of the Roses. I don't know about the Crusades necessarily. I mean, that could be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm actually much more interested in a War of the Roses story that tackled the real history there and puts you in that environment, because that's going to be as close to a Game of Thrones RPG that's not a tacky licensed RPG that you're possibly going to find, I think. All right. So interesting. So I don't know what's going to come of Kingdom Come. I don't know if it's going to have any consequences whatsoever, but it did tap into a thirst for greater, not realism, but a sense of being there.
Right.
Being in the world. Right. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Kingdom Come. I don't really want to talk about it anymore because I personally find it a little boring, but its impact can't be ignored.
No, I can't. And I actually really like your idea of a Napoleon era RPG. I studied the French Revolution a little bit in high school. I forgot nearly everything, but I remember it being very interesting at the time.
I love the Napoleonic Wars. I find that era so interesting. I'm actually reading Master and Commander, the original book by Patrick O'Brien, which is so freaking dense with terminology from that era and sailing jargon, but it really puts you in the moment of that particular period.
Right.
And all of their talk about politics actually makes sense because the main characters are like a learned scholar, doctor, and a captain who has very strong opinions on things.
Yeah, they're going to have very strong opinions on things. That's like a joke. Three of them walk into a bar and have a conversation.
The problem, I think, is a lot of game developers are in America. I mean, Ubisoft's not, but as a consequence, like, Americans don't really know much of anything about the Napoleonic Wars. They just know that Napoleon was a short guy, ostensibly, who was French and kind of silly, and they don't really think of him as both the greatest tactical genius in probably European history, and all of the controversy of, like, he was a dictator, but he did all of these things for France, et cetera, et cetera. Like, the very complicated place that he holds in French history.
But do Americans not study the French Revolution? I told you, I just studied in high school. You guys don't...
Americans don't know anything about the French Revolution.
Well, then again, I did have an American friend. Like, he was amazed when I told him, yes, Canada was in the Great War and the Second World War. He was like, wow, really? And I'm like, yeah, we got massacred in the Great War, and we were first in the Second World War because... We were Britain, essentially. We supported them. So,
not only was Canada in the World War II, they kicked ass.
Yeah,
like all of the soldiers from Australia, New Zealand, Canada, India, they were notably ferocious fighters.
Yeah,
and
Commonwealth.
Americans have such a freaking narrow vision of history that I actually find extremely annoying. And one of my favorite things to do is to always go from a zillion different perspectives. So when somebody gets extremely narrow in their interpretation of history, I get a little bit offended.
Well, that should be the way it is, because history is extremely complicated. I know they say, oh, winners write history, but there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, anybody who says that they know what history, like, happened during history is full of it. I'm sorry. Because... I mean, we're learning new things all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Even about recent history, like, stuff gets uncovered, you learn new things, you dig a little deeper, and you go, oh, okay, so here are some, or so these are what the motivations were. Like,
yeah.
You hear the same story over and over again, but then you go, oh, well, that actually wasn't true at all. Interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the way history was written, it excluded certain people, excluded certain themes, because, oh, we don't want to write about how these people were actually gay, for example. Like, we don't want to write how they're lovers. They were brothers, yes.
My favorite recent historical tidbit, and I'll move on from this after this, is William Henry Harrison. They always say that... Are you familiar with William Henry Harrison?
Yeah, he died in 30 days, right?
He died in 30 days, yes, because he supposedly didn't wear a coat because he wanted to be seen as manly, caught pneumonia, and died.
Good job.
What people actually think happened was that there was sewage... in the White House grounds that affected the drinking water, because we did not really have a sewage system at that time. And as a consequence, William Henry Harrison was drinking sewage water.
That'll do you in.
Caught pneumonia and died.
Okay.
Or something to that effect. So, yeah, that was probably the actual reason, because there were a lot of people getting sick, horribly, horribly sick from that.
You need clean water. It's just one of those things that are a good idea to have around.
So stuff like William Henry Harrison catching a cold that became pneumonia. It's like apocryphal. And I love hearing stuff like that.
Yeah,
I love being told that I was wrong.
And the real answer is actually a lot more interesting. I mean, a cold is mundane. Drinking sewage, yeah, no, that's a death.
So, I don't really particularly care to talk about Kingdom Come that much more, but one thing I do want to talk about, Nadia, is a little while ago, we did an RPG podcast episode about meaningful decisions in games. It originally started with a discussion of quote-unquote good endings and bad endings, and that became much more a case of being able to make meaningful decisions.
Right.
And that got me to thinking, like, what are the most satisfying endings in an RPG? Like, what are some of our favorite endings and why? And I think the first question I want to ask you is, what to you is a satisfying ending? Are you happy with bittersweet endings? Do you like the downer endings? Or are you looking for something a little brighter and happier?
When I was younger, I was really into the happy endings that, like, wrapped everything up. Like, when I was a kid, I really liked Final Fantasy IV's ending because pretty much what you expect to happen actually happens. Like, they get married, the end, hey, oh god, here comes the after years. But as I get older, I find I appreciate more bittersweet, more open endings. And even going back to some endings that I just kind of went, eh, at as a kid, I'm surprised at what I see in, like, I'm like, wow, they put a lot of thought into this ending, and I didn't appreciate it because I was a shithead.
I'm the opposite, actually.
Uh-huh.
I used to be the person who really enjoyed bittersweet endings and open endings, but now I prefer a somewhat happier resolution because I think that it can often be needlessly cruel to... I know these characters aren't real, but
right.
I like a certain sense of resolution. I know that there's no such thing as quote-unquote resolution in real life. Life goes on, right?
Yeah.
And I do like when stories kind of take that approach that it's like, well, I mean, okay, so the story's over. We have had some resolution, but also, like, it's not, oh, wedding bells are ringing and flowers are sprouting and everybody's happy.
Yeah.
But maybe at the same time, though, I look around the world and I am often very concerned about a lot of things that are happening, and the world often seems like kind of an awful place. And so I like stories that make me happy.
No, that's totally understandable. I should reiterate and say that I don't like cruel open-ended stories. Like, I like a little bit of mystery. I like a little bit of resolution. I like that kind of mix. But have you ever read The Handmaid's Tale?
Oh, God, no.
Okay.
I refuse to watch that show because it is so friggin' bleak.
It was our grade 12 curriculum, which is a pretty hardcore book. But anyway, it has a very, very open-ended ending, which is almost open-ended to a cruel point. So that I didn't like. I don't like that sort of thing. But if you want to give me a little bit of a kind of an open ending with a note of hope, like, I think Final Fantasy VII's ending is fantastic before they ruined it with everything that came afterwards, Advent Children, etc. You had that open-ended question. Okay, is the planet knows what's good for it. Does that mean that humans survived Lifestream, or did they get obliterated as a threat? And it doesn't make it very clear, but after the credits, you do kind of hear, like, children's laughter, which indicates, okay, we survived. And, of course, you see Red 13 and his cubs, and even though everything's overgrown, there is a sense that we as people are still there, maybe in a diminished sense, I don't know, but we are still there.
I want to suggest that the world regenerated after the meteor hit, and ultimately destroyed Midgar. Midgar is gone. We're no longer harvesting the planet's life energy or whatever.
Yeah.
But that humans were able to go on.
Right.
I think, as long as we're talking about Final Fantasy, I want to kind of talk about an ending that I don't think, weirdly enough, doesn't get brought up very much, though it was pretty famous and well-known, obviously, when the game came up, which was Final Fantasy X,
mm-hmm.
which actually might be my favorite ending in Final Fantasy, which I feel almost bad about spoiling it for you.
Go ahead.
Nadia, but
I'll be spoiling a few endings, I'm sure.
So the way it works, basically, is after you go, you're on your pilgrimage to Xanarkand, and the whole idea is that you're going to destroy this thing called Sin. And you have to get to Xanarkand to talk to Unalesca, who imbues the summoner with the power to make the final summon and kill Sin. But in the process, that summoner, I believe, dies.
Right.
The summoner dies, which Tidus learns about and is very distraught about. And there's a whole overwrought, I'm so sad. No. What's going on? No. But yeah, anyway. And then you get there and you learn the big twist was, well, no, you don't get there and learn it there. Eventually, it comes to light that somebody has to make it, in addition to the summoner being sacrificed, somebody has to basically become Sin.
Right.
And it comes to light that Tidus's father becomes Sin.
Okay, I think I remember hearing something about that.
Yes, Jekt becomes Sin. He sacrifices himself. Now he's Sin, which is like a whole tortured metaphor about how Tidus has like his father hanging over him and like can't escape his father and
daddy
everything.
Issues.
And major daddy issues. His dad's kind of a jerk. Let's be honest.
Jekt
here, right?
Is a total jerk. Although in Dissidia, there's actually a quote that Golbez says to Tidus, which is his shadow all you see? Which just says it all.
Pretty much. But so you get to Unalesca and you find out that Braska killed himself and Jekt became Sin and Orin died. yeah. So anyway, but you reject this cycle of death,
mm-hmm.
and you ultimately decide to go a different way and you figure out how to kill Sin without having to resort to this thing, and so you break the cycle. And I like anything that's about breaking cycles,
right.
that are really bad. This is a bad cycle. No, the final boss battle. Yes, the final boss battles kind of stink because you fight Jekt, and that boss battle's good, but it has a terrible final boss music.
Oh, is that the one where the screaming guy and the...
Yes, the metal.
Oh, that's awful. I'm yes. sorry. I know they were trying something new, but Jesus, no.
It was interesting, but it didn't work for me.
Exactly.
And then you have much better music as you're fighting this little thing that uses Sin as its armor.
Oh,
but
cute.
Also, if you fight it, as you're fighting it, you always come back to life
because mm-hmm.
you have life 3 cast on you, so you can't really die, so it kind of sucks in that regard. But eventually you defeat Sin. Sin's dead. Yay, everybody's happy. But for various reasons, Tidus is actually a dream or something.
Oh, God.
And so there's a very sad and heartfelt scene where Yuna and Tidus are embracing while Tidus disappears.
That's kind of sad.
And... yeah, no, it's super sad. Everybody's sad. It's very bittersweet. But at the same time, like, it's the promise of rebirth.
Right.
I like stories that carry, yeah, like, it's an uncertain future. We have to deal with a lot of different things. But we can stride together into a hopeful future.
Yeah, there's actually, now that I think about it, Final Fantasy VIII's ending reflects that in a lot of ways, too. Or at least, like, not so much the rebirth, but the very bittersweet sort of ending where you I always like Laguna, and even though he's a dork and an idiot, he tries hard and he can never catch a break. He's basically the unluckiest RPG protagonist out there. So when he gets that kind of serious moment where it's obvious that he's reunited with Squall, and they know each other now, and you know, he's still with his friends, he's still with his adopted daughter, but he visits his wife's grave, and it's just really sad because he never really saw her after he left to go find Alone.
The weird thing about Final Fantasy VIII is that Final Fantasy VIII's ending is that it includes a moment where he gets beamed back to his old orphanage and basically starts the cycle.
Yes.
Again. Because I don't know, like Edea gets infected or something by Ultimecia and she knows that she's going to be a sorceress or something like that. I don't remember very well. But, and of course, Final Fantasy X ultimately got a bit muddled because then they made a sequel.
Oh, right. 10-2.
The first example of a sequel, and it takes place in a world that's a lot happier and everything. And also, Yuna and company have become Charlie's Angels. And there's a gal named Pain, and there are new factions. and Eunice trying to find Tidus, who may actually be alive, because at the post-credit sequence of Final Fantasy X is that you see Tidus is in fact alive and seemingly reborn.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of Final Fantasy X 2, it's like, he's alive, actually. He wasn't actually just a figment of everybody's imagination. Okay.
Oh, you gotta love Square Enix for, like, making you guess for a little while, then just totally going, nope. Guess what?
Nope. Tidus is alive. It's all good. They're happy.
You don't have to be sad anymore.
Yeah. So maybe that really dramatically undercuts the original's ending.
Just a bit.
That's the problem, is that so many great self-contained stories ultimately get sequels.
Yeah.
God, do they ever. So looking at some pretty other good endings, Final Fantasy Tactics is a famous one.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier. That's
I promise this whole conversation won't all be about Final Fantasy. Let's just get the Final Fantasy stuff out of the way.
Okay.
It's we were talking about history earlier. That's an interesting one.
Because as we know, history doesn't wrap things up neatly, and neither does tactics.
No. Delita's basically a villain throughout the entire game, but he's ultimately remembered as a hero, a commoner who becomes king, while the main character, Ramza, dies in obscurity. And the final scene is the history writer being at a grave and kind of reflecting, but then he sees Ramza riding past on a chocobo. And you're like, oh, I think Ramza gets a happy ending here. But then, of course, the history writer is ultimately burned at the stake by the church.
Nobody wins.
Oh, no. Ramza got his happy ending.
Well, I guess riding on a chocobo does count as a happy ending.
Maybe that's more of a realistic ending, just in the sense of you're not going to change the world. The world's not going to change. As the Wyro would tell you, systems remain in place. You can't get rid of the system's going to kill everything. But you can have individual happy endings.
You can try.
Perhaps the only way to have a happy ending is to retire to a vineyard in the middle of nowhere and make wine and just enjoy yourself and not worry about things too much.
Is there an ending like that in any video game?
Yeah, Witcher 3.
Okay, yeah.
Yes.
I think Geralt deserves that.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe Geralt deserves it.
Oh, is this a soft G versus hard G thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's totally a soft Geralt. G. Nadia, why is Secret of Mana such a downer ending?
Well, number one, spoilers. Number two, both Secret of Mana and Adventures of Mana, a.k.a. Final Fantasy Adventures, they both have very similar endings in that somebody is going to be left behind. Somebody is going to, quote-unquote, die, or at least be transformed to a point where they can't interact with the world as we know it anymore. Secret of Mana, which is fresher in my mind because I just finished it, that has two things happen to you. Number one, you're chasing Dylok across creation, and he, in the very end, he becomes possessed by Thanatos. So, to stop Thanatos from absorbing ultimate power, because Dylok himself actually has a lot of ultimate power inside of him, Dylok kills himself. And that forces Thanatos to basically release himself into his true form, which is vulnerable. So, you kill Thanatos, and then you go up against the Mana Beast, who is trying to destroy the fortress, and that will restore mana. But if you kill the Mana Beast, which you had no choice, then mana will no longer exist in the world, because it can't be restored. And if that happens, then creatures of mana, like the Sprite, they will disappear. So essentially, you finish the game, and the Sprite doesn't quite die, but he disappears. He vanishes from our world and becomes part of his own. The world becomes separate. So you basically strike the final blow on the Mana Beast, and the hero and the girl realize, oh, he's gone, and we never got to say goodbye. And you see him at the end credits just kind of like looking out over the moon. So it's just a really kind of a downer ending.
Man. I don't know. I don't like dark it. Downer endings, man. I hate games that make me feel sad.
Adventures of Mana was the same way, where the hero is protecting this girl who, it turns out, has to become the next Mana Tree. And so, even though they're in love, it's like, well, you can't be together. Oh, well, that sucks. I guess that's that. And yeah, that's basically what the Mana games are all about, apparently. But you do have, you still do have that cycle of rebirth, although that was more prominent in Adventures of Mana, not so much in Secret of Mana, because there's no more Mana anymore. Like, the Mana tree is dead. The Mana beast is dead. Go to hell, I guess.
What do you think of cliffhangers?
Oh, God. Here's the problem with cliffhangers. If you're a Mega Man fan, you know what the problem with cliffhangers is. Mega Man is still on the moon, and he ain't coming back. That's Mega Man Legends 2. Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of them, unless you can promise me the next game is coming out. And you can't.
Will actually resolve it?
That's true. I hate cliffhangers, that and then you get the next game, it doesn't resolve anything, it doesn't touch anything. That makes me so mad.
That's what happened to Wheel of Time.
Oh.
There was a cliffhanger. I mean, no, the series ended.
Oh, okay.
But there was a cliffhanger in one book that didn't get resolved for like 3 or 4 books.
Oh, boy.
It was insane. Another good example of an unresolved cliffhanger in an RPG, Xenosaga.
Oh,
Xenosaga,
right,
yes. Episode 3 ends with like Cosmos flying through space and like a lot of like things are kind of bad, but it never resolves because Xenosaga's never getting another game.
No, well, she went back to her home planet. It needed her.
Thank you. Mass Effect, of course. Mass Effect Andromeda is another game that I think is going to not really... It's going to kind of have an unresolved cliffhanger.
Yeah, I'm not even sure how that one ended.
You'll forgive me. My memory is a little hazy on this front. It ends with you ultimately getting a foothold in Andromeda, the Andromeda galaxy and
right.
everything. And you defeated an enemy, but it's very open-ended. There are a lot of threads that can be potentially picked up for a sequel. I don't
right.
think that's ever going to happen.
Not for a long time, if ever. I think Mass Effect's going to sleep for a little while.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
But maybe Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3, great games, and we were talking about them a little while ago. Great self-contained trilogy, and maybe that's all we need?
At this point, that's what you have to deal with, yeah.
As for the actual endings, I thought Mass Effect 1 and 2 had excellent endings for the most part.
I've never actually seen them.
So Mass Effect 1 has just a great climax. And I think a great climax can really tie into a really strong ending.
Mm-hmm.
Which I feel like I'm undermining my point with Final Fantasy X a lot now.
Whoops. Oh, well.
But basically what happens is you are going after the... it comes to light that there are these things called Reapers, and the main guy that you've been chasing the entire game, Saren, is controlled by a Reaper, and Saren's ship is, in fact, the Reaper.
Right.
And there's a huge space battle around the main station that you've been using, which was built a long time ago.
Right.
And it comes to light that, in fact, the hyperspace network that you've been using this entire time was a trap!
Oh my god.
It was a trap, and what happens is that the Reapers use it to beam into our galaxy and then take them over,
mm-hmm.
cutting off all of the different galactic civilizations, and then they just pick them off piecemeal, one by one, as to destroy them. And their whole goal is just to destroy everybody. So I love that aspect of ancient technology that we don't understand being turned against us.
Right, right.
And so that's a great revelation. And so there's a huge space battle as all of the Alliance fleet comes out to attack the Reaper. You're jumping, you are on the outside of the main space station that you've been on this entire time, fighting enemies as you're bouncing through space, which is just a phenomenal set piece, even for mm-hmm. as janky as Mass Effect was back in 2007. Man, if I could remaster any game, it would be that one.
Yeah,
I would that one remastered. Yeah.
Just listening to you talk about it, I'm like, oh man, this is Star Control.
Yeah, so you're bouncing on the outside of it. You get back into the station, and you find Saris. I think his name's Saris. Saren? Oh, God, I don't remember. I don't know the main villain's name. You find the main villain's name, my main villain, and... You can do a little bit of a fallout in that you can actually get him to shoot himself in the head and badly damage himself if you convince him. But mostly you're going to have to fight him.
Right.
And also while this is happening, the Alliance fleet gets into trouble, and you can either save them, and you could save the Alliance console and things continue as normal, or you can let the humans come in, or you can let them die, and the humans ultimately take them out and ultimately take over the Federation.
Awesome.
Yeah, so you can be evil and let humans step in. And I did that. I let the latter one happen.
How badly did we screw it up? How fast?
I don't remember, actually, because I don't remember humans controlling the Federation to be a huge plot threat in Mass Effect 2, because in Mass Effect 2, you go over to a renegade organization called Cerberus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so... And then I picked up Mass Effect 3... And all the humans die because Earth immediately gets attacked, like, right at the beginning.
Oh, whoops. That sucked.
Mass Effect 2, meanwhile, has a suicide mission, which is just probably the best, one of the best conclusions I've ever played. Yeah, the actual fight against the Terminator boss battle, Terminator baby, is kind of lame. The revelation is pretty neat. And the just extreme tension of... like losing a crew member, you don't want to lose a crew member.
Right.
So I going in without any spoilers is so exciting and terrifying. The game drops a lot of hints for you. Hey, you might want to upgrade your ship all the way. You might want to make sure that you got everybody's loyalty by doing their loyalty missions. Hint, hint. And if you exercise common sense and send the people who are like, oh, well, okay, probably you want somebody who's a good fighter to do this,
right,
to lead this team, or I probably want somebody who is good at tech,
right,
to be going through the Jeffries tubes to handle things over here. You'll be fine. I didn't lose anybody on my first try. But what's even more fun is to... let everybody die.
Oh, no.
And then let Shepard die.
Oh, dear. Does everyone become martyrs?
Well, the game just ends. You know, it's over. And there's an ending, and they're like, I think Joker's real sad. Joker's the pilot of your ship. Joker's very sad. And it, like, moves on. But when Mass Effect 3 picks up, it's like, well, I mean, yes, your story ended with Mass Effect 2, but that was the end of that. So here's what would have happened if Shepard had lived.
Yeah, we should actually give a shout out to games that have those you failed endings. They're actually quite common in RPGs. You ever see the one from Chrono Trigger? I don't know if you saw that.
No.
You didn't see it?
No.
If you die, you see Lavos basically.
Right.
You might have to be up against Lavos when it happens, but yeah, the world.
It refused to change.
Yeah, the future refused to change.
Yes.
That and Breath of Fire, too, had a pretty grim one. You find out, basically, the dragon, this giant dragon who's been living in your hometown the whole time is your mother, Ryu's mother. And she's been blocking, physically, this gate that this demon is behind. And she gives you a choice and says, do you want to go down and confront the demon, which is a pain in the ass, or do you want to have me block the gate for as long as possible? And if you choose, let's block the gate, that sounds like a great idea, basically the world ends, because the demon's just like, just walks on, he doesn't care. How's it going, guys?
Valkyrie Profile, if you manage to piss off Odin enough, which is possible, because like you send the wrong people who die, you keep everything, all the treasures for yourself, etc., eventually they will go, well... so we don't know what's wrong with you, but you die now. They say something to the effect of, a machine that goes off on its own and can't be controlled is of no use to us.
Well,
and then
it's fair.
The thing is that it was always, I could never get that ending. I tried everything possible to get Odin mad enough at me to kill me, but I couldn't do it for some reason.
I guess you have to be, like, a real jerk to do that. Like, I'm always paranoid about being too much of a jerk when I play RPGs, but to actually, like, physically do it that much, it's kind of like the genocide ending in Undertale. I can never bring myself to get that one.
You know, when it comes to Suikoden 2, so I think the endings in that game are pretty good.
Yeah.
And But weirdly enough, I think the best ending is the normal ending. The best of them. Because the one that's extremely bittersweet, where the group, like, all kind of go their separate ways and everything. Just because that strikes me as more realistic than the happy ending where everybody ends up together and kind of go off on their own.
Yeah, I actually don't like the happy ending for that game because I feel like, number one, it's way too shonen for a RPG that's as realistic and political as it is. Mm. And I really don't like the way Joey just kind of turns his back on Julia, who some fans speculate that she was actually pregnant at the time, which just makes it worse for me.
Whoa.
And he actually turns his back on, what's her name too, the little girl. Like, to be with his friends, like, that's just so... something very childish about that. And that's a character who went through a lot of hardcore development. So just to see that really irritated me.
Could you lay out what happens in the Suikoden 2 ending for people who aren't familiar with it?
You know what? I never got it myself personally because I always screwed up that one vital thing. But I've seen it, like, online and stuff like that. So basically, it turns out... what's the name of the girl? Naniki? I'm just blanking on her...
Yeah, I'm totally blanking on her name, too.
Well, she dies at some point in the game. And if you get the good ending, it turns out, oh, she was just pretending the whole time. And oh,
surprise!
Look, here's Joey. We're friends again. And Joey has, like, if you're following the plot, has just, like, he's stabbed you in the back. He's really hurt you. He's not a good person, but he has his own reasons for doing things. So to just kind of, like, say, hey, we're friends again. Let's all be friends like we were... you know, in the olden days. And that's the thing about Suikoden 2, is that it's supposed to be a game about not going back to that youthful, innocent time. You can't. It starts off with a bunch of children getting massacred.
Indeed, that's true. Yeah, so in that respect, I kind of like the ending where it's an ending, but it's also kind of a bittersweet ending.
Yeah.
And here I've been saying this entire time that I don't like it. I like endings that make me feel good and happy. I don't know.
But we were just.
I like ending. I like life affirming endings, I suppose.
Yeah, I totally understand where you're coming from. But I, like I said, I don't think that that good quote unquote ending is a life affirming one. I just think it's silly. I'm not a fan.
Or I should say, I like life affirming endings that feel earned.
Okay. Yes. There you go. And that's another thing about that good ending is it's hard to earn because, God, isn't there like one vital stupid little thing you have to do at some point in the game, and you have like a split second to do it, and that determines if you get the ending or not. And you might also need all 108 stars. I can't remember.
Yeah, I think so. Here's an ending that's kind of a downer ending. Planescape Torment, you basically go to hell.
Oh dear. I guess you don't earn that ticket to hell. You just go there.
Yeah, because the whole point of the game is that you have been you are the nameless one, and you have been reviving over and over again throughout a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But in Planescape Torment, you are being chased by something called the Transcendent One, and that is your mortality.
Oh dear!
They have split from you, and eventually, if you can get the good ending, which takes a lot of work, the quote-unquote good ending. You eventually are able to convince the Transcendent One to merge back with you.
Right.
So you either defeat it or you merge it back with you and you're capable of dying. And in merging back with you, all of your past selves like come back to life.
Right.
So they have a kind of a happy ending and everything, except you go to hell. You have to fight the bloody wars for eternity. Sorry.
Wow. Like, I guess that's their version of hell, where you have to fight the war for eternity.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. That's... So you die. You got to fight the wars for eternity.
That's mean.
Yeah, it's kind of dark, isn't it?
Mean ending.
It's the heroic I guess you could call that a heroic sacrifice ending.
Sure, but going to hell for eternity. That's one consequence.
Fallout also has a dark ending.
Yeah, it does.
Are you familiar with it?
You were just kind of referencing it a little while ago with you convinced
Fallout
the,
One.
Fallout One, where you convinced the vault. Head of the vault to shoot himself, I believe.
Oh yeah, that's one of them.
Oh okay.
I mean, that's like that can be the climax, but after you, it's not that you convince the head of the vault to kill themselves. You convince, I believe, the head of the super mutants to kill themselves, and I think that was Fallout 2. I want to say.
So I never played 1 or 2.
In Fallout 1, when you save the world from an army of super mutants, you return to your vault. only to have the overseer turn you out because they're afraid of you.
Right.
So the final shot is of the main character wandering the wastes, gone. And it's sad.
It is very sad.
Yeah, no, you aren't accepted by your own people. And here's the kicker. If you have like the bloody disgusting perk or something to that effect, the parting, your character's parting shot will be to shoot the overseer in the head and then leave.
Nice.
So that's a fun one.
Yeah.
Fallout 2 ends with, in Fallout 2, there's a new society that you can either save. Mm-hmm. There are a variety of ways that it can end. It can end up in a war with another group.
Right.
Or it can end up making peace with them, and that's maybe the happiest of the endings. But so much of Fallout is just about understanding that the wasteland is always going to be the wasteland. It's just trying to find your peace with it.
Yeah, pretty much. That's one thing about Fallout. Even if you finish it, everything's still covered in radioactive waste, so do your best.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm kind of curious, Nadia, what is your favorite ending in an RPG?
Oh, it's very hard for me to pick because, again, sometimes I'm in the mood for, like, a happy ending, sometimes I'm in the mood for a bittersweet one. I always had a soft spot for Final Fantasy VI's ending, just because, even if I don't find it completely satisfying on a story level, I find its presentation is pretty much top-notch. The fact that there is a 25-minute song at the end on the SNES that doesn't loop, that's pretty incredible. It's very cinematic. And it does have its story moments. Like, it definitely has that message of, like, restoration and rebirth. It actually literally ends with a new kid being born, and Terra finding her spot in the world. And everyone kind of flies off, so you get the impression that, well, they're all together, they'll figure things out themselves. It's a happy enough ending, I suppose. It just kind of ties well together.
I think that, first I want to give a shout out to Earthbound. I like the simplicity of the ending, just in you have, two people walking home.
Yeah, that's a very cute, very satisfying, heartfelt ending. That's what I'm looking for. It's a very heartfelt ending. I think Jeff literally tells you to just see her home, see Paula home. It's very cute.
Indeed. And I think my favorite ending, personally, is Valkyrie Profile. And I feel like I've talked about it. I just like how earned it feels.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, it's the real ending, let's be honest. And in that sense, it's kind of the only ending where you're going to get any resolution whatsoever, which can be kind of annoying, to be honest. But I like that, essentially, it's Ragnarok. And
right.
You're fighting through Ragnarok. It has some of the best boss battles in the game take place during Ragnarok when Loki goes crazy and sets everything off. I like that you reunite with all of your party members that you've sent up to heaven.
That's
and
nice,
have
yeah.
them in your party as you're fighting through. And then I like that it ends with the Valkyrie restoring the world.
Right.
And basically becoming God.
Yeah.
And you want to talk about like cycle of rebirth. That is a great example of rebirth.
Right,
and
right.
A very kind of a hopeful future and everything. Weirdly enough, Valkyrie Profile 2 takes that ending. And so one of the main characters is Lazard Veleth, he's basically a creeper. He's etchy. And he, in the game, Valkyrie Profile 2 takes place well, like hundreds of years before Valkyrie Profile, because in Valkyrie Profile, there's a moment where you go back in time and you see some things. Well, you go back in Valkyrie Profile 2 takes place entirely during that time.
Right.
And it resolves a lot of threads from the original Valkyrie Profile. And then I believe it comes to light that Lazard Veleth is, I think, time traveling.
Like he does.
Because he's in your party in Silmaria. And you're like, that's weird that he's in your party. But I believe it's time traveling or something, but it's all a ruse so that he can eventually capture Lenneth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he's able to capture Lenneth and imprison her, and you have to merge with Silmaria, the Valkyrie who's inside you, to become the Valkyrie again and defeat him. I believe that's how it all goes. And also Arngrim is in there somewhere. I think I prefer just the regular ending of Valkyrie Profile. I don't think that every thread has to be resolved, do you?
No, I don't think so. I think it all depends on the game itself. But no, if they leave some threads open, I'm usually okay with that. As long as it's nothing like, oh my god, what happened? What happened? You gotta tell me. But no, it's sometimes you just gotta be mature about and let the writers have their own way with things.
Yeah, open to interpretation, to circle back to the beginning of this discussion, I think can be pretty good.
Yeah.
I really like... I think that a game, particularly a game, can get in trouble when it tries to answer every single question.
Oh, absolutely.
I just did a ranking of all of the Metal Gear Solid games, which you should go check out. I think that it was a pretty good list myself. And I talked at some length about how Metal Gear Solid 4 got into trouble for trying to do just that, answering all of the mysteries. Sometimes it's better not to answer the mysteries.
Yes, as a fan of Five Nights at Freddy's, I can confirm that is the case, because that is a game with many mysteries, and some of the answers are, well, they've kind of cleaned things up nicely, but some of the answers are just off the wall.
What's your favorite RPG ending? I kind of want to know. Drop a line in the comments or send us an email at usgamer@usgamer.net. All right, Nadia, let's do a quick Cosmic Star Heroine report, which is more of a Cosmic Star Heroine check-in.
Yeah.
Because I don't think we've played particularly a lot, but we've managed to get a bit further. And so I've got a new party member, Nadia.
Yay, new friend.
Yeah, it's a termite or something.
Oh, I have him too. That's a Saib, I think his name is, or Saibi. I'm not sure if I recognize it. Do you say eBay?
Viba? Okay, so my partner used to work for somebody named Viba, mm-hmm. who is Dutch, and he spelled his name roughly like Saib. Or so I'm just going with Siba or something like that.
Okay. I can buy it.
Yeah. So Siba or Viva or whatever his name is a bug who uses songs and is a support monster. And well, what do you think of Siba, Viva, Saib?
I am all for support monsters, especially like bugs, because in most, let's say most sci-fi RPG settings, the bugs are usually dull, hive mind, usually very mean towards humans. But this dude's a good chap. He's very polite. He's good kind. Chap. He's a good chap. He's a good bug. I like him. He's smart. He's kind. He's not exactly like the most brilliant personality in the room, but he's got some really great attacks. Like he's got, as you mentioned, the songs, like Pain Song and the Rebirth Song, which belong to Lauren, except his are far more powerful.
You think so?
I think so. When I was like, because I was using Lauren straight up until I switched him out for the bug, and I noticed that Saibi's Pain Song does a lot more damage than Lauren's.
Whenever I see Pain Song, I think of Animaniacs, where they did a random Beatles episode.
I remember that.
And Yoko Ono saying, "I will sing my love song," and then it's lots and lots of screeching. So I imagine that's what the Pain Song is for us, Sibe and Lauren and all that. I incorporated him into my party in the place of Chan, just because I thought that he filled an interesting gap. And mm-hmm. while Chan, I think, is much more powerful when it comes to support, I really like Sibe's like damage potential, because between him and Arit, they do a lot of damage over time. So I've been just freaking tearing through enemies. It's been ridiculous.
Yeah, fights are definitely going a little bit faster now. I still use Chan because I still use her as an attacker with her flame torch and with focus, which attacks everyone. I find that just a really good combo, and then I use Echo, which fires the flame torch again, and if you have an enemy that's weak to fire, that's pretty much the end for them.
Yeah, I'm doing like thousands of points of damage right now, mm-hmm. which is good, because there's a boss at the end of the mines, because you have to take Seabay, Sai, whatever, into a mine area. It's actually not a bad dungeon because you have to manipulate these mine carts to get through. I mean,
yeah, I'm doing that right now.
A lot of it is kind of finding your way to a switch and then moving the minecart up and then continuing onward, which is fine. Mm-hmm. One thing that's just a tiny nitpick about Cosmic Star Heroine, it's not always easy to see what the door, where the doors are if they're on the bottom of the screen.
I agree. I actually got stuck in the bug town because they're talking to me about a terminal. And I'm like, oh, this terminal over here, right? Nope, not that terminal. The one that's like right beside a character and looks like it's part of the background. That terminal.
But the mines, in the mines, there are a lot of doors that are very hidden. And so you have to kind of feel your way around. There's a lot of traversal stuff. But the boss at the end of it is this giant specter thing, which has like 20,000 hit points. And is actually fairly difficult. You better have your party settled for this boss, because he is one of those bosses that becomes more powerful as the battle wears on.
Right.
And can start one-shotting your characters really quickly.
Right. It's got a lot of style.
Well, what happens is initially, not doing too much damage, but he has an attack that will both stun and make your character vulnerable.
Oh.
And they will stay vulnerable until they actually get hit again. And if they get hit while vulnerable, they will take a lot of damage, like hundreds of points of damage. The first time, and sometimes you can just bring them back immediately. You can bring them back from the verge of death by healing because they're in negative point territory.
Right.
But other times you're just not going to be able, they'll just get one shot and they're dead.
Right.
And you're not easily able to revive characters. So
no.
You really just have to push forward and wipe it out as fast as humanly possible. And I was able to do that with Seabay, Saib, Weebay, by using, like, I was doing a ton of damage over time.
Mm-hmm.
I was hitting with like some really powerful burst attacks from Sue, because I had this whole thing where I can get Sue's into hyper mode and then use this one attack that lowers defense but does just absurd amounts of damage.
Oh yeah, that's the bum rush.
Yes. Bum rush with style at maximum plus boosted attack will do several thousand points worth of damage. And so you're good there. And then also the extra style attacks, the unity attacks do a lot of damage. And then, but even still, I actually did get killed the first time I tried to take it on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks for the warning.
So be careful with that. You want to take it out as fast as possible. I was actually thinking, like, man, I wonder if Chan would actually be a better fit than Seabay, Saib. But I think that character is actually locked in, so you can't swap it out.
Well,
you need to keep your termite.
I did swap him out, but
okay.
He might need to... It's probably one of those situations where you get to a certain point and you have to use him. So I can imagine having to use him against the boss. I haven't gotten there yet, though.
Well, the flip side is that it might actually be better to just hit it as hard as humanly possible.
Mm-hmm.
And not worry too much about trying to heal or revive people, because if you try to revive people, they'll just kill somebody else really fast.
Yeah.
So
that's one man, but, and one nasty ghost.
There are times where when you're fighting a boss, it's not worth reviving characters because they are killing you so fast that you will just get stuck into a position where you're not doing enough damage. You're just spending all of your time trying to heal.
Yeah.
And just getting worn down steadily. And that's the case with this one. But I was able to kill it. I was able to kill it
Yay.
On my second try without losing anybody at that.
Good.
So once you have it down,
that's good.
The problem was that the first time it killed a Reet, and I lost her damage over time, and that was bad.
Yeah, that would be bad.
Because she does a lot of damage by herself. And also she boosts the party with like attacks, attack boosts and everything. So,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I finally left the Firefly / Bug Planet.
Oh, good. So you're off on your way somewhere else now.
Yes. So I now have the technology to block out the technology that takes control of everybody's minds.
Right.
So when you meet Saibay, Saibay, Weebay, throws you into another dimension and says, where your mind is basically being controlled and you have to fight a boss in that universe. And then it's revealed that it's like, oh yeah, I basically took control of you briefly and gave you a taste of the power of this technology. Now we have to stop it.
Oh, that's not nice.
Yeah.
I called it a nice like bug.
So you have to go and get the crystals to go fix that.
Right.
And yeah. And once you do that, you're good. But now I don't know why. I have to go to another planet, a lawyer planet, maybe.
The planet of lawyers.
So I went there and I met a new character. Their name is Orson Bolivar. So what happens and right from the start is you go and you meet the mayor and the mayor likes you, but then the mayor gets poisoned and dies.
Oh dear.
And you are immediately accused of it and and you have to find a lawyer to represent you, and Orson is the only one who's going to represent you.
The blob, great.
Yes, like a chicken. Purple blob. It's like a purple blob, kind of like an eggplant almost.
Does it
eggplant least, blob?
Does it at least carry a briefcase and have a hat?
It has a gun.
Okay, that's a thing.
The gun will, like, the first time you see it, it's sitting behind a desk, and it raises its hand, and then a gun appears in it for no really good reason, aside from the fact that it's kind of cool.
Maybe rule they just, instead of lawyer badges, that's what they have.
Rule guns. Of cool, as they say in TV tropes.
That's it, all right.
Yes, so Orson is interesting because Orson is extremely good against spirits and can turn characters into spirits.
Oh, cool.
And do extra damage to them. Also, very strong elemental attacks if you just want to hit really hard.
Right.
I think that Orson can be a solid replacement for, just can basically be your heavy DPS damage dealer in your party. But I am in the process at this moment of walking around trying to gather evidence that supports my case.
Oh boy. That sounds very Phoenix Wright-ish.
It brought me back to thinking about court cases in other RPGs. Obviously, a really good example is Chrono Trigger.
Right, which literally took it from the wall.
I like that one, though, because it's a very funny scene.
It is. It's pretty great.
It's basically a kangaroo court where you're going to get convicted no matter what.
Yeah, I was shocked, actually, when your behavior at the fair was used against you in that court case.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, isn't it?
That was like, oh my god, they turned the tables on me. How did they do this? No, I wasn't pulling her to kidnap her. I was pulling her because she was taking her time.
In Disgaea 2, they will actually use your playtime against you.
Ouch.
Yeah, you can end up in a court case in Disgaea 2 where if you've played more than 100 hours, they'll use that as evidence against you.
What do they say? You're twisted and have no life? Not worth saving?
Basically, you spend too much time playing video games.
Wow, that's some psychomantic shit right there.
Yeah, right? But probably one of the better examples of a court case in an RPG, and I've been talking about Mass Effect all day, it seems like, but in Mass Effect 2, you find out that Tali has to return to her flotilla. Tali is, I don't know, she looks like, she's wearing an environmental suit, and you don't know what she looks like from most of the time. You're like, what the heck does Tali look like? Is she cute? She has a nice body. You have to go back and defend the honor of your father because you're going to be expelled from the fleet. It's very Star Trek, actually. In Star Trek The Next Generation, Worf has to go back to because his father's been accused of horrible crimes.
Of course.
Well, it turns out the father actually did commit horrible crimes.
Whoops. Oh, dear.
And if you bring that to light and bring that evidence to light, the father will be posthumously exiled from the fleet and Tali will hate you.
Aww.
And you will lose her loyalty and there's a decent chance she will die.
Oh no. So what does she look like?
I don't actually know. I never did see behind the mask. I think that they eventually reveal that. I could be wrong, but that's a mystery. Even if you date Tali in Mass Effect, there's a sex scene where the mask is, like, cast aside.
Okay, so it's not like the Tusken Raiders, at least.
And you only see the mask. You don't really see her.
Right. That's still kind of weird.
But there are a lot of ways that the actual court case can unfold. And it can end with you getting Tally exonerated if you can gather like all of the right evidence and talk to the right people and then have the right traits.
Right.
Like charming and that kind of thing. Or it could end with her being exiled, but she's still loyal to you. So right. It's kind of a bittersweet ending. Or like I said, it can end with you revealing what her father did and just blowing up the entirety. Like, wow. It's like creating sectarian violence and getting Tally and Tally's real mad at you and the whole nine yards. Maybe you don't want to do that one.
No.
But there's a lot of different paths toward resolving this quest, and it's actually a really good one, I think. Yeah, some of a lot of the loyalty quests in Mass Effect 2 are really good.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested to see what Cosmic Star Heroine does with its court case. But I've got this planet and another planet besides, so we might not be that close to being done.
No, I think we're not. It averages, I think, maybe 20 hours, somewhere between 10 and 20.
We're in chapter 10 now.
Right.
I've been really distracted by other games, but I think this is where I think we really need to knuckle down and just like play through a whole bunch of this game so that we can freaking get it done. So yeah. We're not playing it forever. And we can get another report going.
Yeah.
Not that I don't like Cosmic Star Heroine, but geez, we were supposed to do this because it was fast. Okay.
More fool us.
All right. That's the end of this week's Cosmic Star Heroine. Unless you have anything you want to add, Nadia.
I think bugs are cool.
Good ending. Okay, Nadia, as usual, we did the messages from the people who listened to this podcast. There was plenty of discussion about which version of Secret of Mana to play. Let's see. As you know, this podcast went up on Monday.
Right.
Last Monday, and somebody was saying that they really like this time slot and we should keep it, and I think we will. You should play Legend of Mana instead, since drinking with Skeleton.
I play Legend of Mana, not a fan.
Dave Del Rimple 11 says, the first time I stepped into the woods outside the Witch's Castle in the remake, I was absolutely slaughtered by those Chobin hoods. They are nasty.
Yeah, they're relentless.
Skyward Shadow says, I just got caught up on the backlog, and they really enjoy hearing the FF9 report and now the Cosmic Star Heroine report. I bought CSH on release, but my expectations were too high. I was expecting the next Suikoden 2. Cat, over the last months, you've mentioned how much you enjoy creating and tweaking parties of characters. I wonder if you'd enjoy Ogre Battle March of the Black Queen, as I feel that's a core component of the game. It's a Matsuno game to boot.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Ogre Battle March of the Black Queen is good, but I prefer the original Tactics Ogre myself. Gamer Law says, you know that you're in for a great episode of the pod when Kat starts with a discussion of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Yeah, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
And if they recall correctly, Nadia was among the first to express reservations about the remake when it was announced. I find myself somewhat surprised that she warmed to it as much as she has.
Yeah, what can I say? It's just a weird little remake, like... especially the soundtrack. I kind of sit there like saying, I hate this, but I love this. What is wrong? What is going on here? So, yeah. Secret of Mana.
Gamer Law hated it.
A+.
Gamer Law hated it.
What's that? Oh, yeah. Some people hate it. Like, Parrish hated it. Schreier hated it, but he didn't finish it. Like, he played like 2 hours of it. And you kind of give it a little more chance than that. But, like I said, you kind of have to separate yourself from your memories a little bit to really appreciate it. So I did that.
As they pointed out, repeated in-game car crashes, subpar voice acting, issues with the AI that become especially pronounced in combat. All of these lead me to the same conclusion that Kat arrived at. Play the original on the SNES Classic. Yes.
Honestly, the AI is not as bad as the original game. Not at all. No, I don't know where that comes from. I found it a lot less frustrating than the original games. Voice acting, I didn't use the voice acting. I used the Japanese voice acting, which was fine. Yes, there was a lot of crashing. That is inexcusable. The only saving grace for that is that it auto-saves a lot. but if it didn't, I'd be in a lot of trouble because, yeah, it crashed, especially towards the end of the game. Just boom, boom.
And
boom,
Funktron says, "I'm not as far into Cosmic Star Heroine as you all, but I did the battle system, dig the battle system so far. I appreciate how different the abilities of each characters are and the complicated ways multiple characters can interact. Its system emphasizes each battle, which makes them more interesting, but makes them longer and removes the lizard brain pressure of just hitting attack and slaughtering everything. Another minus you seem to have hit is that once you find a strategy that works everywhere, repeating it mindlessly isn't that fun. Chrono Trigger, on the other hand, is a more traditional model where your characters get progressively worn down between battles and managing your MP and resources add to the tension. As I think Nadia pointed out, you have ultra-powerful moves you can pull up for bosses, and the regular battles are interesting enough to be fun without being individually challenging. I think the lack of random battles let the characters pace things perfectly. Another good battle system is Paper Mario's. The special timing to make strong attacks and blocks keep each other battle engaging, and choosing accessory makes for interesting trade-offs.
I'm actually hoping for... The only reason I really want a GameCube emulator on Switch is because I want Paper Mario.
That would be kind of nice, wouldn't it? And then we could actually play it. That'd be a good report, wouldn't it?
That'd be a good report.
But we will have to decide on that for now. Axe of Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are sold. Follow us on all of the social medias. I'm at @_capbot. Nadia's at Nadia Oxford. And also, we can follow US Gamer and all of the different things. We stream every Tuesday and Thursday. Mike is usually the one streaming. Sometimes we play PUBG, and it's a lot of fun. But we also play new games, too. We play Metal Gear Survive. A lot of people popped in because they're curious about that game. Spoiler alert, I don't think it's that good. Mike seems ambivalent about it. He's like, it's not so bad.
I may have been thinking of Bob Mackie seems to like it a lot. Apparently he loves it. Apparently he says it's like Dragon Quest Builders, only maybe better. Yeah.
Okay, I respect Bob's opinion on games a lot, so maybe there is some merit to it. But I've seen a lot of back and forth on this one. It seems pretty divisive. Frankly, I don't think it should exist, but that's me. If you're going to make a Metal Gear game, just make another goddamn Metal Gear game, and we can just accept that it's apocryphal or whatever, but... and by the way, go read my rankings of the best Metal Gear games, because I put a lot of work into it. I was literally up until 3 a.m. writing it.
She did. She worked very hard on it.
Yeah, because I had to go to an event the next day, and it needed to go up, but I digress. Nadia, you're on another podcast. It's called the US Gamer Podcast. It's our flagship podcast. What did you all talk about?
We talked a lot about the Sonic movie that's coming out in 2019. We speculated. We went to some horrible territory.
You can't talk about Sonic without going into some horrible territory.
Yeah, it's impossible. I tried. All right. It doesn't work.
We'll be back next week, as usual. I'm going to make Nadia play some Radiant Historia, and we're going to play a little bit of that Final Fantasy XV mobile game, and we'll have lots of thoughts on that. And as usual, we will be back with all of the RPG discussion. But until then, I've been Cat Bailey, and for Nadia and myself, thanks for listening, and until then, happy adventuring. We'll be right back.